Eric Jung, welcome to The Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me today. Looking forward to chatting all about what's happening in the silver market.
Well, thank you, Tom, for having me on the show again. That's been a while.
It has. And, you know, I appreciate you coming on. And I'm looking forward to trying our best to kind of separate everything that is happening in the silver market, silver and gold market right now. You know, it's such a complex web. And I think, you know, as you and I have discussed, it's in a way deliberately complex in order to make it harder to understand, right?
I think, yes, Tom, because the system is built in such a way that it reinforces itself. And, you know, people like me and you, or just the regular Joe out there, we're not meant to understand how this big complex system is supposed to work. Mm-hmm. But fortunately, with your help and others, I think I've figured out most of it. So we can get into it and talk about it, and I can share my knowledge, and hopefully others will learn or contribute to this conversation.
Yeah, I mean, that's always my goal, is to basically have many of these conversations and be able to, in a way, this is an ongoing process of figuring these things out and being able to have, you know, different pieces of data from different people. So, you know, we've been seeing reports of refiners no longer taking scrap at the moment, the LBMA possibly having trouble delivering. And, you know, there's also no shares of the SLV to borrow. So obviously, again, these are, you know, let's say kind of signposts along the way. What do you think the best place is to start for understanding this grand picture of what's exactly happening in the silver market?
So, Tom, I think the best place to start is TD, you know, Daniel from TD, and Robert Gottlieb, who is the executive at the JP Morgan's Bullion Bank, and he had his own X account. He deleted that. Now he's on LinkedIn.
Yeah.
I think it's a good place to start is to just talk about the LBMA free float or physical silver that these guys talked about for the last year. Okay. So my recollection is this. In the last, you know, just 2 weeks, a month ago, these two gentlemen came out and said that, you know, the market is tight with the LBMA 1000 troy ounce bars. And, you know, the LBMA free float is down to maybe 5,000 to 7,000 metric tons mm-hmm. of physical silver. So that was the information that we got from these guys. And then all of a sudden, you saw this, right? Like how this evolved. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden, last week, Robert Gottlieb and also Daniel came out and said, or Daniel didn't say it, but Robert did, announced that the free float is zero. There's no free float anymore at the LBMA. So I asked myself, Tom, what the heck happened? How did it get from 5,000 to zero in 2 weeks?
Uh-huh.
Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think?
Well, either it was not there in the first place, or there was somehow somebody demanded that 5,000 metric tons.
Okay, so at the same time last week when all this happened, when, like, you know, when Rob announced this fact, which is shocking, we also got news that sporadically, for most of the time in the last week, SLV, which is the ETF for silver in the West, the biggest one, custodianed by HSBC and our favorite bullion bank, JP Morgan, it basically for many of these days, announced that it had no shares to be borrowed for redeeming physical silver out of the SLV vault. And then what's the other thing that happened? Lease rates at local London spiked up. First, to 10%, 11%, 20%, 30%. And we heard rumors that there are these rates out there that exceed 100%. And then today, I got news, again from JP Morgan, that the banks don't even want to quote each other prices and these rates anymore.
Right.
Think about
just,
that. So,
and just for some context, we're recording this on the morning of October 14th here for me, late evening for you. So just for some context for listeners of when we're actually recording this. So going back to the exploding lease rates, Eric.
Okay, yeah. So now we know, we established the fact that, number one, there's no free float at London, at the LBMA, or physical silver. And SLV, the ETF is not really letting people borrow shares to redeem for physical silver. So that route of getting LBMA bars, the 1,000 ounce bars, is no longer, a valid and option. And then we also talked about the lease rate, which is super high. In my opinion, that just really equals to, we don't want to let you guys borrow or lease any of our silver bars, which JP Morgan basically said today, right? Because he said that the banks don't even want to quote at this point.
They don't want to what? Sorry, Eric?
They don't want to quote. They don't want to quote prices.
Okay.
Quotes prices. Sorry. Yeah. So my conclusion is that, and it's not even my conclusion, it's a fact that the entire paper and physical silver market in London is seized up, is frozen.
Yeah.
The system is no longer working at all. So I asked this question this morning. I said, which is the first bank that came out and refused to let the other banks borrow their silver bars? Because if you understand how it works, Tom, the way that the LBMA works is that all these banks, usually the big four that the clearing banks at the LBMA, HSBC and JP Morgan, a few of them, they trade promissory notes amongst each other. And supposedly, you interviewed David Jensen?
Yeah.
Supposedly, the paper contracts to physical are 400 to 1 in ratio. So what happens when there are more entities in the context of, let's say, sovereigns or industrial users, stand for physical delivery, and the free float is heading to zero? At some point, one of these banks will see the writing on the wall, and it will just stop lending its physical silver to the other banks. And I think that's what happened. It just, one of these banks stopped, and the entire system froze. And that's what we're seeing right now.
Eric, do you think that if that is the case, that one of these banks stopped, that was driven by current price action or let's say, price action a month ago?
I think that's part of it, Tom. But also the fact that, like I said, the free float is down to a very dangerous low level. I think that is actually probably the key factor in all of this. Is that the physical silver at the LBMA in London is just simply not sufficient. So at this point, like Rob said, it's simply not there. And that's why we are where we are right now.
Yeah, and I think the difference here is that under normal market conditions, this would all be, working without stress, right? But with the added upward pressure of price, the added upward demand curve that we're seeing, I think that's where these dislocations start to show themselves in a market that, under normal circumstances is like works, but under these current circumstances is showing the stress, right?
Well, absolutely, Tom. I mean, you know, you have people like Rob and others pointing at the backwardation between the spot price at the LBMA and the futures price at the COMEX for physical silver and say, hey, there's an arbitrage opportunity for these bullion banks to take advantage of via the EFP mechanism so that they can stand for delivery at the closest, you know, futures month at the COMEX, mm-hmm. take delivery of the silver and then take it to London and deliver it at the LBMA. So I understand that train of thought and logic. That's all fine. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, based on my research and, you know, for the last week and for the last couple of years, okay, I think what really is happening is that, like you said, Tom, I know that you are insinuating to that, which is the bullion banks themselves probably have a lot of short positions at the LBMA. And as the price of silver rise up, their short positions may be underwater as well, right? So they need to cover. And what I think is happening is that, yes, there might be arbitrage opportunity, but more likely what's happening is that these bullion banks probably slamming the price of silver at the COMEX to entice. Oh, I said it on my X account, actually, I said they're slamming the forward months. So, like, you know, December, etc. And then to entice the CTAs to offload their 1,000-ounce bars at the COMEX for the closest futures month, which is this month. And then the bullion banks would take those 1,000-ounce bars, take it back to London, and they can cover mm-hmm. whatever leverage positions that they have, because the leasing and lending market for the 1,000-ounce bars in London is no longer functional. You see my logic? So that's the only way that they can get these 1,000-ounce bars, right? So that's what I see happening. And it just looks like it's playing out as we speak.
So, Eric, what do you think the risk is to the LBMA right now? Is it when people try to stand for delivery and they don't deliver that they, you know, that presents this... really this knowledge that maybe they don't have the amount of metal that they say they do? Is it that they lose pricing power? Like, what do you see as the risk to the LBMA at this point?
Okay, before we talk about the risk, let's talk about what the LBMA is doing to prevent, like, you know, what you just talked about from happening. Okay, so two things that the LBMA is doing right now is to going off to their 1,000-ounce LBMA silver bar ounce, 1,000-ounce silver bars customers, like the ETFs in India. And they're trying to convince these people to stop new subscription to these silver ETFs. So basically what I'm saying is that the LBMA is trying to contain the contagion so that the supply, you know, this supply squeeze doesn't spread to their global customer base, like the Indian ETFs that buy the LBMA silver bars. So supposedly they had some success, because I have my Indian followers on X telling me that some ETFs are in fact stopping new subscription, you know, to those ETFs so that they don't no longer are buying, you know, the 1,000-ounce silver bars from the LBMA. So as you can see, that will lessen the physical silver demand pressure on the LBMA. At the same time, what is the LBMA doing? It's going to all their Western smelter partners and it's saying, hey guys, we really need these 1,000-ounce LBMA 1,000-ounce silver bars. So these smelters, what they are doing is that they actually, you know, telling their buyers, okay, whoever is, you know, the recyclers who are buying up the scrap silver, etc., they're telling them, we are no longer accepting anything less than 999 purity.
Yeah.
Because 999 is the LBMA standard, right? So does that make any sense? Because if they have to, let's say, take, you know, junk silver, which is less than 999, they got to purify that stuff to 999.
Takes extra time.
Like refine it. They don't have that time. So it's all hands on deck to get these 999 LBMA 1000 troy ounce silver bars pumped out for the LBMA. So everything we're seeing, Tom, is like a symptom of what is happening in London. That's it. Yeah. So in terms of like your question, if they are successful, then, you know, maybe the price of silver goes up a bit more. They're able to unwind their short positions and life goes on. If they are unsuccessful in doing that with the current things that they're doing, okay, they might have to talk to the US government to, you know, get the COMEX to release even more of these 1,000 ounce bars to the LBMA to resolve the situation.
So, Eric, do you think that this is only, you know, obviously there's a major stress in the LBMA, but is this only about basically London and the West? Like, how do we separate the different demand vectors from, let's say, China and the Shanghai physical exchange there? You mentioned India. Like, are these qualitatively different sources of demand?
I think the problem that we're facing here is that it's a global demand problem, mm-hmm. what we see, which means that, you know, China, India, if you don't, like, let's say let silver's price rise to a higher level where these other, you know, parties like China and India are forced to go somewhere else to look for cheaper silver, what they will, you know, ultimately do is they will go back to the LBMA and buy the 1,000 ounce LBMA silver. Mm-hmm. And then we're back to where we are right now. You see what I'm saying? So ultimately what I'm saying is that they got to let the silver price go up. Like, price is the only solution to this problem. If price doesn't go up, we always have this problem.
And whoever has positions, you know, short positions in the process, that gets, you know, resolved one way or the other as price climbs, as kind of collateral damage on that, on the way to that price discovery or that new price point.
The problem is, Tom, we don't know how many entities are standing for physical delivery in London right now.
Right.
We simply have no idea. Mm-hmm. So these are bilateral contracts between the buyer and the seller. And I guess, again, it goes back to, you know, what I see is that if there are many buyers who are standing for physical delivery, and whatever silver bars that are going from the COMEX to the LBMA right now is still insufficient to fulfill the needs of those buyers, mm-hmm. at the LBMA, what's going to happen is that this arbitrage, this backwardation that we see between the two places, the LBMA and the COMEX, should close.
Right.
Narrow, right? Or like at parity, because, you know, as you have more demand in the LBMA, and supposedly all these guys are right, then there should be more silver going from the COMEX to the LBMA. Mm-hmm. And if you have more silver going from the COMEX to the LBMA, you're bidding up the price of the silver at the COMEX, therefore narrowing the price differentiation between the two places.
Because of that demand.
Because of the demand, correct. Mm-hmm. So it all comes down to the demand. We don't know. We don't know how much demand there is at the LBMA. We have no idea how many people, how many entities are standing for physical delivery over there right now.
And again, I think that that plays into that opacity of this market, which, I mean, is somewhat understandable. And I think you've mentioned on Twitter as well that there's not even any way to see what lease rates actually are at the LBMA between these parties, right?
Yes. I think they stopped, like, you know, quoting lease rates in 2015 for gold. Uh-huh. And for silver, I don't think they ever quoted the lease rates. But like the lease rates that we see mostly are implied lease rates that are calculated from forward, you know, contract prices. So that's what we see. But sometimes the insiders come out and then they tell us what the lease rate is for that particular period of time. And that's how we know.
Eric, how do you think the value of the dollar plays into this equation right now? You know, if we see the value of the dollar all of a sudden slide or strengthen, does that end up affecting this market in a different way as well?
You know, Tom, I think all of this, you know, they are crosswinds that all affect each other. Mm-hmm. And I actually posted something on my X account just today. I said, this is a contest between the physical metals liquidity versus the US dollar liquidity. That's mm-hmm. what it is. Mm-hmm. So on one hand, you have the physical metals and, you know, that's liquidity right there. If it dries out, you're in big trouble because that's the collateral or the product that you are trading. On the other hand, you have the US dollar, which, you know, of course, is the funding cost to run these exchanges, you know, or these bilateral contracts. Mm-hmm. So, of course, Tom, you know, the value of the US dollar is part of this equation. As a matter of fact, I was speaking to one of my friends on X, and that person told me that the reason why initially yesterday, once the silver price crossed $50 at the LBMA, and then you have the futures price on the COMEX approaching that, we saw a big dump of prices, right? Supposedly that's because of a funding issue in terms of US dollar liquidity. Okay. So, well, that may have been also initiated by Donald Trump, right? Because Donald Trump came out and said that he's going to throw 100% tariffs on China. So all of a sudden you have a liquidity contraction spike. And then, you know, the funding desk, they have to sell the futures positions on the COMEX. And that's why we saw that dump. Mm-hmm. Now, today, you know, all day, we see that the prices on both the COMEX and the LBMA for silver and gold are being bid up again. So, to back to your question, yes, it, you know, because we are still living in a US dollar liquidity predominant world, okay, the USD does matter. Mm-hmm. And that's an example of that. There you have it.
Eric, how does the EFP, the exchange for physical, and the ETFs play in here? You know, it's been alleged, let's say, by different people that the ETFs are basically, you know, liquidity sinks for the exchanges and vice versa. Like, how do you think those other, let's say, mechanisms or pools of metal play into this?
So the way I explain the system is that you have the LBMA, the COMEX, and you have the ETFs. And you have physical metal at all three places. And they're tied together by what? The EFPs, the exchange for physical mechanism.
Yeah.
And normally, you know, when things working well, they just get cash settled, and the bullion banks make some arbitrage money or like basis trade money from two locations. They're happy. Mm-hmm. When the system is in stress at one location in terms of physical inventory of a certain metal, gold or silver, then what these bullion banks do is that they take the metal from another location and they use the exchange for physical mechanism or exchange for physical backdoor to transport that metal to the location that needs the metal. Like what we're seeing right now, the bullion banks are taking metal from the COMEX, and by EFP, they are funneling it to London, to the LBMA. And to your question, Tom, the ETFs, yes, they are, like I call them the physical metal piggy banks for the bullion banks. Because normally when they don't have enough metal, let's say at the COMEX or the LBMA, they would just do what I, you know, told you early in the program, which is they would borrow shares from SLV or GLD, and then they would redeem physical metal from those ETFs, and then take that metal and transport it to the COMEX or the LBMA. Mm-hmm. But like I said early in the program, right now, at least for SLV, it seems like JP Morgan is saying no. They don't want metals or silver to massively flow out of the SLV ETFs.
So what do you think is, let's say, the ultimate outcome here, or the, let's say, why don't we illustrate what could be the, let's say, the best and worst case scenarios coming through this, Eric?
The best case scenario, Tom, is the orderly deleveraging of the bullion banks' short positions at both the LBMA and the COMEX, and let the, you know, price of silver rise up gradually to reflect the true inherent value of silver in the world today. Mm-hmm. So that's the, I think, the best case scenario. The worst case scenario is that the LBMA ends up doing a force majeure, just like what happened to nickel at the LME mm-hmm. back a couple of years ago. You're aware of that?
Yep.
And if the LBMA does that, then I think the pricing mechanism for the entire world for physical gold and silver will probably go to the COMEX and the Shanghai Gold Exchange. Mm-hmm. So that's the worst case scenario.
Because of a loss of confidence in the LBMA?
Because the LBMA essentially defaulted.
Right.
I mean, it's defaulting right now, but like what we're talking about, it's a technical default.
Right.
In the case of a technical default, not even technical, like in reality, it's defaulted, right? If it force majeures, then I think the SGE and COMEX will take over. Mm-hmm.
So for those that might not be familiar, Eric, can you explain to us what happened with that nickel situation at the LME?
Well, there were big players who shorted the nickel. And then nickel's price got squeezed and just rocketed. And the LME canceled contracts. It not only force majeure, it canceled trades. Mm-hmm. That's what happened to nickel. So I don't know if that's going to happen at the LBMA. But like I said, if that happens, then I don't think the LBMA is going to be a price setting exchange or OTC mm-hmm. for the world anymore.
You know, Eric, I've seen a couple different tweets and, let's say, rumblings. For example, I think it was the CEO of Wheaton Precious Metals came out and said that central banks might start adding silver to their balance sheets. What do you think the likelihood of that is?
I think it's possible because Russia already did that. Russia already added silver to the reserves. So the next nation that I see possibly doing that is India. And then guess what, Tom? Judy Shelton, in her latest interview, mm-hmm. said that it's possible that if the U.S. start utilizing precious metals as reserves, silver will be part of it alongside gold. So it's nothing outrageous here. I mean, all the people who are a lot smarter than me are saying it. If they are saying it, I think it potentially got a shot at becoming reality.
But okay, let's talk through that a bit though, Eric. Didn't Russia declare it a strategic metal, and didn't they buy it, I want to say through their sovereign wealth fund or something like that, just to have a stockpile, not necessarily as, let's say, a backstop for their currency?
Well, that's the first step, Tom. But the second step may be that they're going to use physical silver as a collateral for the international trade, just like gold, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think like gold is what everybody is going to be using in the global south, because China is building the infrastructure for that. But for global south countries who are silver rich, not necessarily gold rich, they might want to use silver as a collateral for the international trade. And I, you know, honestly, Tom, I see that potentially happening because of the way, you know, that India is buying so much silver. A lot of people ask me, like, I mean, on my, I have a Red Note account, and people ask me, what is India doing with all that silver? I mean, India is not a huge industrial player in terms of using silver to manufacture products like China. Like, China has a reason to import all that silver, the mixed stuff. What is India doing with all that silver? And my only explanation for that is that potentially they're going to use it as a, you know, collateral for the international trade.
Mm-hmm.
Just like what you suggested when we began this conversation.
But, you know, thinking about the constraints of that from a, you know, at a central bank level, seems to me counterintuitive, because the amount, like the physical amount, the volumetric amount of silver that you're going to need to, you know, serve as collateral is, you know, so impractical compared to gold. But is it more so that they're just moving to the next metal? Like, why wouldn't they add platinum or something like that? Something that is more valuable per, you know, cubic foot or cubic inch rather than silver?
Tom, they might, but gold and silver have a history of being a monetary metals, not platinum. So silver has that history going for it. And also, you know, like you said yourself, even though silver is less dense in terms of its monetary value, there's a lot more silver compared to platinum. And right. More global south countries mine silver versus platinum. Not that many global south countries mine platinum.
Yeah.
But a lot of them have silver. So, you know, back to what Vince Lenzi told you in your interview with him,
uh-huh.
It will make sense to have a bimetallic collateral system to include silver in the equation. It might not, you know, constitute like 50% of it. But even if, let's say, you have 80% gold and 20% silver, it will help out a lot of these global south countries to have the liquidity that they need to develop their economies locally.
Right, because they have the silver available to be able to serve as collateral in that type of, you know, currency regime or currency exchange.
Correct. And it might not make sense, Tom, at $50, but it'll make sense at $200, for example.
Yeah.
There you have it, right? $200 silver? That makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm saying is that not only that the price of gold is going to go up potentially because of its new use case as a global south HQLA repo collateral, but also if silver gets into that boat, silver will get revalued to a higher, you know, price, USD price, for that purpose.
So who do you think is going to drive that? Is that more the BRICS countries and the global south? And then there are, let's say, that forces the US to follow suit?
You know what? I think the Global South countries are doing it already. They're like, you know, laying the foundation for that to happen. And the interesting thing is that if you listen to Judy Shelton, she's saying the exact same thing that we are talking about here, that she wants the US to do. So I think what will happen is there will be two parallel systems. You have the BRICS countries using gold and silver as collateral for their, you know, repo, offshore repo, interbanking repo, liquidity, etc. The Western world would remain using U.S. treasuries as collateral, U.S. dollars as the predominant, you know, currency for liquidity. But what I do see is what Judy Shelton is proposing, the U.S. treasury gold bonds. And she's also proposing like a stable coin that is backed by gold and silver. I see those as a bridge between the two systems.
Right.
That's what I see. So if, let's say, you are a Western country or the U.S., you know, company or whatever, you want to do business with the Global South, you can use these gold-backed U.S. Treasury bonds or, you know, gold and silver-backed U.S. cryptos, stable coins, and you can plug those in to the system that the Global South, the BRICS, is building.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, this is basically just an evolving currency system that basically, the, you know, China and the BRICS countries are sick of being pushed around and bullied by the US dollar, having the dollar used as a weapon against them. And this is, you know, the natural evolution of a system that doesn't serve everyone equally.
Correct. And I think if once China establishes all these offshore gold vaults and is able to launch this gold collateral successfully, I think then the Global South countries will have an alternative to the U.S. Treasury bonds as collateral and U.S. dollar as liquidity for their own economies.
Yeah. How long do you think that build-out takes for China to be able to have all these offshore vaults?
You know, Tom, I think, like, you know, they're moving faster than I anticipated. Uh-huh. It might actually happen within 12 to 18 months.
Wow.
Just because of necessity, mm-hmm. because of the tension that China and the BRICS countries have with the U.S. As a matter of fact, I jokingly say that Donald Trump is speeding it up. Every time Donald Trump opens his mouth, the timetable gets speed up by a couple months for this to happen. And, you know, off camera, we were also discussing the other criteria that must happen to make this work for China and the Global South countries.
So yeah, let's jump into those, because, you know, you can't just create a new currency without making it attractive for people to use, right?
Correct. So the two other criteria that I developed in my thinking, and I also wrote short articles about this, and I put it on my Red Notes and Exocards. People seem to like it. I showed it to people who are working in the system, and they think it makes sense. It's this, and it's based on, by the way, Tom, based on the work that Sotan Posa did in the last 2 years that he published, that we all read. So basically, Sotan Posa said that the Global South, for the longest time, their resources are being extracted by the West at an artificial cheap price. And we talked about suppression, how the prices of the Global South commodities, silver, gold, is being suppressed by the West. And how it works is they suppress the prices of these commodities. They import these commodities from the Global South, which are the ex-colonies of the West. They would manufacture stuff. Okay, the manufacturing now is done by China. So China is the proxy for the manufacturing. But the design and the intellectual property is owned by the West.
Mm-hmm.
So this entire, you know, manufacturing value chain, the global South countries get the least monetary payback, okay? Because they, like I said, they're being suppressed. China get a little bit of money from being the global factory for the entire world.
Yeah.
The biggest cut of margin goes to the West. So that's how it worked in the past. Now, China wants these global South countries to jump on board to a new system, essentially, using gold and potentially silver to be collateral. Now, first thing is, using silver as collateral, like I said, is helping these global South countries. But what did we say? In order to use silver as collateral, you need to rise the price of silver. So along with the price of silver going up, I see the prices of most commodities going up to help lift these global South countries from poverty so that they can make more fiat money from the sales of these commodities in a more fair manner. Mm-hmm. That's what I see. So that's the second component to that, that China can no longer work with bullion banks like JP Morgan to suppress the price of silver. They have to let it go up. So maybe that's the reason that every time Donald Trump opened his mouth fighting with China, we see the price of silver go up a couple bucks.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the reason, right? So that's the second component to making this work. The third component I see is technology. So China has to prove to the rest of the global South countries that it can stand on its own with, you know, technology that it developed by itself. Like, you know, EV, it already happened. Like, a lot of people don't remember, but 5 years ago, 6 years ago, China wasn't even a blip in the automobile manufacturing sector. It was all the Europeans, the Germans, Japanese cars. They dominated the scene, right? It may be Tesla. Am I correct? And China really just got into this 5 years ago. And now China is making some of the best electric vehicles that money can buy. So that's number one. That's the electric vehicles that the global South will need for transportation so that, you know, what they saw happen to Iraq won't happen to them. If you remember, the U.S. sanctioned Iraq, and there were stories coming out from Iraq that the citizens were driving cars that were like Toyotas that were 20 years old. I think it's still happening in Cuba right now, isn't it, Tom?
Yeah.
That like they sanctioned Cuba, so Cuba, they're still driving American cars from like 40 years ago. Uh-huh. They managed to keep it running. So anyway, the whole point is, global South countries need reassurances that, you know, technology that China develops can satisfy their needs. So electric vehicles is one of them. And you have AI. China has its own AI now, right? The DeepSeek, which is comparable to the AI that the West developed. And most recently, I don't know if you heard, Tom, China also is catching up with a semiconductor industry. So I think that's the final kind of like technological barrier that China need to conquer in order to prove to the rest of the global South countries that it can stand on its own on the technological or technology like side of things.
How do you think they're going about using, you know, again, I see China is being so strategic and having this long-term thinking. You know, this other lever they have to pull is the rare earths refinement capability that they've developed. And they're now withholding that over the US, which is, you know, strategically important to not only the electric car industry, as you said, electric motors, you know, permanent magnets, but also the defense industry.
Well, I think the whole purpose of China's rare earths is not really a sanction. It's like a limited export by China. It's to not let the U.S. military have access to these rare earths from China and you know, also the technology from China to refine the rare earths, you know, not have American military have access to this so that they can build weapons against China.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's the point that China is trying to make. In terms of like civilian use, China already said you're an American company, you apply for like a permit for like a specific quantity of this rare earths, and China will look at it and they will approve it on a case by case basis.
Right.
So that's the information that I got. It's not like a total ban of export and of these rare earths to the West.
Yeah. You know, I think it's just such an interesting process. And that's really what this needs to be thought of as, not only the revaluation or the price discovery of gold and silver, but as well, this rise of a new, let's say, global reserve currency that the global South is going to be using. You know, I think you posted a while ago that there's billboards in China talking about the yuan becoming a new global currency. That's been around for a while, has it not?
Yeah, somebody told me it has been around for 15 years. So, you know, that just shows you, Tom, that China plans ahead.
Yeah.
It has been thinking about diversifying or moving away from the US dollar for a while.
Uh-huh.
And that just shows it, Richter.
Well, Eric, I think that's a good place to kind of wrap up for today. Is there anything else that you think is important for listeners to consider before we do?
I think, like I said last time on your show, Tom, I think your listeners, if they do not own any physical gold and silver, it's never too late to start.
Mm-hmm.
And if they're fearful of, you know, I'm going to put this in quotation marks, high prices of gold and silver right now, they can do like a dollar cost average approach. Uh-huh. And buy some now, buy some maybe a week from now, a month from now, etc. But we are moving into a new monetary order. You know, from all the evidence that I provided you and all your other guests provided you.
Mm-hmm.
And it's gold and silver is going to play a big role in this new global monetary order. So everybody should own some physical gold and silver, in my opinion.
Yeah. I think those that are scared of high prices, you just have to ask yourself one question: is the fiat currency that you're operating in, do you think it's going to be, more of it is going to be printed in the next 5 to 10 years or less? And I think that answer, you know, presents itself quite elegantly.
I agree, Tom.
Eric, one last thing, I guess. You know, where do people go if, you know, gold and silver do become unobtainable? Do you think that forces people into the miners?
Yeah, I wrote something like that on my pinned post on my X account. I said, at some point, you know, physical gold and silver is going to be very difficult for regular people to get into.
Uh-huh.
So they will be forced to buy physical gold and silver proxy. And the best thing, you know, next to ETFs, which I think are scams, we can discuss that in another show, right?
Yeah.
Are the miners, right? And in that scenario, the miners will fly. So yes, I do agree with that. I think miners are a good alternative to physical gold and silver if you cannot get a hold of the physical gold and silver. Of course, if you pick the right miner, not just any miner, buy a good one that is not just a hole in the ground, that actually has the gold and silver in it.
Absolutely. Of course, for anybody that wants to follow you, Eric, you're available on X at KingKong9888. Eric, thanks so much for your time today and helping us try to understand a little bit of what's going on in the markets right now.
Thank you, Tom. My pleasure.